Dr. Leslie Blackhall is one of the investigators who, beginning in the 1990s, raised the question whether our increasing and overwhelming commitment to free and informed consent might have problematic consequences if it were applied injudiciously. Her concern was primarily the cultural groups which would find the notion of an individual invariably and autonomously and individually making decisions about their own health care problematic and even repugnant. She tells the story of a patient who was Chinese, who brought her mother in to a physician to be seen about a lump in her breast. It was clear that there was a high probability that the patient had cancer, and the physician felt obliged to explain the implications of this, the possibilities of the need for a mastectomy and for other, perhaps for radiation and other forms of therapy, and insisted on doing this despite the fact that both the patient and her daughter seemed to be agitated. I should mention that the patient was having her having the text translated for her entirely by her daughter. At the end, of the interview, the patient and a daughter seemed eager to leave. The physician insisted on a return appointment to schedule a proper biopsy. However, the patients were completely lost to follow-up, and no efforts to recontact them were successful. Sometime later, the physician did encounter the daughter and was informed that it was precisely the attempt to explain everything, to lay everything on the table, that had been perceived as so horrifically insensitive and crass to the patient that it caused the patient not to want to return for further medical care. So there may well be circumstances in which one's insensitive approach to and commitment to the idea of patients needing to have all the information to make their own decisions may actually work against good patient care. And I might add that there is an unfortunate growing tendency in some subcultures within the medical community to step back from the notion of clearly informed and free consent in favor, particularly in the area of cancer care, to require that patients have a, quote, proper attitude towards being a cancer survivor, meaning that any discussion of the likelihood of a particular protocol not to result in a remission or the patient's possibility of needing to face imminent death should not be considered because, quote, that would mean that you won't get the result you could get if you had the right attitude, unquote. So there are all kinds of dangerous steppings back from the notion of autonomy, some of which may be understandable and others of which may be reprehensible, but we need to spend just a few minutes looking in particular at Dr. Blackhall's question in regard to ethnicity. Her study from the mid-90s was undertaken in Los Angeles, and her conclusions, if you drop down to main outcomes, were that Korean Americans and Mexican Americans were significantly less likely than European Americans or African Americans to believe that a patient should be told the diagnosis of metastatic cancer, and the same group was less likely to believe that a patient should be told of a terminal prognosis, and less likely to believe that the patient should be required to make decisions about the use of life-supporting technology. Rather, these groups in particular, Korean Americans and Mexican Americans, believe that the family should make decisions about the use of life support. And this is important to bear in mind. It does not mean that one abandons principles of informed consent when one is working with particular cultural subgroups, but that one recognizes sensitively the nature of the expectation within the community and seeks to work with it rather than plunging ahead and alienating the whole process by insisting on a different model of communicating this information. And her conclusions that Korean-American and Mexican-American subjects are more likely to hold a family-centered model of medical decision-making rather than a patient autonomy model that is favored by most of the rest of the culture, suggests, as she says, that physicians should ask their patients if they wish to receive information and make decisions, or if they prefer that their families handle such matters. Because one of the factors that is often forgotten in the need to insist on and try to assure informed consent is that patients have the right to refuse to be told their condition, or to be told all the aspects of their condition, if they would prefer that someone else be the primary decision maker for them or with them. This is permissible, but oftentimes it is neglected. And so if we can look at the general discussion from her paper, and I've given you the full text of the paper if you wish to review it in the course reading materials. Here I've simply excerpted the beginning and the end of the paper. She points out, and this is helpful for us to remember historically, that when this paper was written in the mid-90s, she said that for the past 25 years, the legal analysis of medical decision-making revolved around the idea of patient autonomy. It was fundamentally believed that patients have the right to make informed decisions about their medical care, and that they should be told the truth regarding their diagnosis and prognosis, risks and benefits of proposed treatments, and should be allowed to make choices on based on that information. So this has been the fundamental conviction that has arisen, as we saw, as a result of the shocking revelations at Nuremberg and the evolution of this principle, its application first from the idea of medical experimentation, more broadly to the notion of any treatment, and particularly treatment that involves significant complications or touches on end-of-life issues. And she points out that this ideal is so central that it has resulted in the notion of advance directives, which we will consider in more detail, which is an attempt to make sure that the patient's ability to make their own decisions is respected, even when the patient can no longer speak for themselves. And she notes also that there is a federal statute that has been enacted, that was enacted in the 90s, to enhance and preserve patient autonomy. But, she goes on to say, there are other values, such as family integrity and physician responsibility, that have in some senses been ignored, and this approach to autonomy is, or may well be, a cultural bias on the part of Western medical and bioethical communities. And one might add, in particular, American and to some extent English-speaking medical communities, because this approach to informed consent is not necessarily found even in Western medicine as it's practiced in some Mediterranean countries, or as we'll see in other parts of Europe, and certainly not necessarily in the Far East or Asia or in Africa. She points out in her comment that, and if we drop down a little further, that the Korean-American and Mexican-American groups generally tended, when they were older, or if they tended to have a lower socioeconomic status, or if they tended to be less educated, there was an increased tendency to be opposed to truth-telling and patient decision-making much more strongly than younger, wealthier, or more educated counterparts. So this, too, is something that one needs to bear in mind when working particularly with people from these cultures, that it's not just being in the culture, but also age, socioeconomic status, and level of education that can make a significant difference in one's preferences in regard to whether the individual is supposed to make the decision on their own or whether the family is expected to be involved or indeed even to make the decision. And a little further down, highlighted in white, she describes the decision-making style exhibited by the Mexican-American and Korean-American subjects in her study as what she calls family-centered. And by this, she means, as she goes on to say, that in this model, it is the sole responsibility of the family to hear bad news about the patient's diagnosis and prognosis and to make the difficult decisions about life support. She goes on to say that in Italy, this is regarded as a way of protecting an individual from bad news, being protected by the family and physicians. In some cultures, this approach is regarded as a way of respecting the elder, who is not required because of their maturity authority and their status to have to grapple with or wrestle with these painful questions. Rather, they need to be grappled with and wrestled with by their family members, who will then communicate to them very gently the appropriate decision that needs to be made. Again, it's not a question of isolating the person, but rather recognizing or believing, especially in some groups, that the person should be spared the pain of having to bear this decision on their own or to bear it alone. And she reports anecdotal, that is to say, not substantiated by statistically analyzed data, a tendency of Chinese and Ethiopian families to oppose truth-telling based on the notion that it harms the patient by causing them to lose hope. And she points out that in Europe, in Spain, France, and Eastern Europe, as well as in Japan, physicians rarely tell patients with cancer their diagnosis or prognosis, instead usually informing the family. So the practices on which we so strongly insist in the United States are not necessarily universal, even throughout what would classically be described as the Western medical practicing world, and indeed it is not necessarily the case even in Great Britain, where often it is not necessary to obtain the patient's consent, but instead to document that a conversation with the patient has taken place. This is somewhat variable, but the notion that patients need to be given all the information and make all the options of treatment is not necessarily regarded as appropriate when the physician regards themselves as the one to make the best choice about treatment options. Dr. Blackhall highlights the point that there was a tremendous shift from 1961 to 1979, noting that in 1961, 90% of physicians did not inform their patients of a diagnosis of cancer, but by 1979, 97% of physicians did this, and of course this was because the law was not only encouraging, but inevitably forcing them to do this. And it was viewed as a shift from, as she puts it, an uninformed paternalism to a more enlightened and respectful attitude toward patients. And one needs to be reminded that indeed that is the case in the majority of circumstances if one's dealing with an American population, that is to say, if one's dealing with a population in this country and not necessarily with a subpopulation where it's been demonstrated that there is a strong ethnic concern for involving the family. So it's not necessarily the case that this is problematic, that one's calling into question the whole issue of either patient autonomy or of informed consent, but rather that one is seeking to comprehend and work with cultural expectations that one otherwise might be tempted to ignore and which could actually work to the detriment of the patient's care. And in the areas that I have indented and highlighted with numbers 1, 2, and 3, Dr. Blackhall highlights the benefits of open truth-telling with patients. Number one, it's probably impossible to completely deceive seriously ill patients. Patients know when they are dying. Patients very often are aware of their diagnosis, even when the physician seeks to cloak it, conceal it, or to sugarcoat it. And number two, acknowledgement of the truth allows patients to express their feelings, receive the emotional and spiritual comfort that's appropriate to the crisis they're experiencing. And of course, we should add here that the spiritual comfort would include a sacramental care and pastoral care as well. And number three, allowing patients to choose from the range of treatment options, make sure that the treatment, this seems like a tautology, obvious, will conform to their preferences. Some patients may find certain forms of therapy absolutely repugnant and should not have those forced on them. And Dr. Blackhall goes on to point out that, in fact, people do live, as she puts it, live, get sick, and die, embedded in the context of family and culture. They do not exist simply as individuals, but in a web of relationships. And in some cultures, these relationships are absolutely vital and cannot be ignored, or should never be ignored, but are often even more significant than one might imagine. And finally, at the very end of the article, in the section sections highlighted both in red and then rather in white with red text and then in black text. She says, it is vital to uncover the usually unspoken beliefs and assumptions that are common among patients of particular ethnicities to raise the sensitivity of physicians and others who work with this group. Understanding that such attitudes exist will allow physicians to recognize and avoid potential difficulties in communication, to elicit and negotiate differences when they occur. And it should be added that the physician is never alone in doing this, that social services, the social workers, the nurses, oftentimes members of bioethics committees, and chaplains can also be of great assistance in facilitating conversations that enable healthcare providers and family members to come to a clearer understanding of the expectations both of the social group to which patients belong and certainly of the patients themselves in the context of that group. And so, in conclusion, at the very bottom of the article, or at least in the bottom of the section that I've excerpted here, she says that allowing a patient to choose a family-centered decision-making style, which could mean that the patient turns over the responsibility for making decisions to family members, Dr. Blackhall emphasizes, this does not mean abandoning our commitment to individual autonomy or its legal expression in the doctrine of informed consent. Rather, it means broadening our view of autonomy so that respect for persons includes respect for the cultural values they bring with them to the decision-making process. So here we see a necessary expansion of and corrective to what could easily become an excessive or extreme form of the doctrine of informed consent, in which one seeks to effectively isolate the individual and insist that they, in their autonomous context, make their own decision. Whereas in reality, people are part of a culture, often part of families, and sensitivity to the degree of involvement, the significance of these relationships in facilitating a process of decision-making is absolutely essential in all who care for the sick.